Hello and welcome to Radio Edu Talk. This is David Noble in a certain coffee shop in Stirling Services on a Sunday evening, so a bit of a different environment for a Edu Talk show. And I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening Jim Scott, who is a senior lecturer in teaching and research at the University of Dundee. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here in these very salubrious environments.
And hopefully the ambient noise won't distract you from what's going to be a very interesting show, no doubt, and will attract some comment. And if you want to get in touch with the show, if you're listening to the podcast, you can get in touch by email. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or you can pop something up on Twitter and just include the hashtag edutalk, and we'll be sure to pass any comments or questions on to Jim. So Jim, just to start off with, can you give us a brief background to your career in education and more latterly in academia?
Most of my existence has been as a secondary head teacher. I started off as a maths teacher. I was either the first or the second principal teacher of computing. I was one of those people who moved from maths to computing. And then I was head teacher of a number of schools. A significant acting period in Fife and Glenwood High School when my head teacher was unwell. And then I sort of swapped places with him because he'd been deputy in Glenwood High and I became head teacher there in Falkirk. In Grahamhound, Falkirk, sorry, and then I moved to Perth High School laterally. So I have had the odd parachute mission as well. In academia, my main research interests are in leadership and governance of education. That's what I did my thesis on, and it's the thing I'm most interested in. But historically, my main research interest has been curriculum, both the implementation of the curriculum and the theory, or in many cases in Scotland, the lack of theory that lies behind it. And I also have a side interest, which was a bit of an accident, but seems to have become something that people know me for, which is an interest in modern languages as well. And that's pretty much it, I think.
That's great. Now, we have got a number of issues that we're going to touch on during tonight's show, and as usual, we may stray beyond half an hour or so, but hopefully you'll enjoy the discussion and the information and the opinions that the Jim's going to give over the next 25 minutes to half an hour. So you spoke about curriculum there, Jim. So just to start off with, can you kind of set the scene about where you feel we are at the moment across Scottish education, with particular emphasis on where you feel we are at present with Curriculum for Excellence?
I'm obviously better qualified as a secondary person to talk about the secondary part of Curriculum for Excellence. Now, from what little research I've done into the primary implementation, it seems to have gone better than the secondary. So I'm really going to talk about the secondary one, because as the OECD said last year, there is tremendous potential interest and success in CFE, but we maybe haven't quite got there yet. Like many people in Scotland, I wrote an evidence paper for the OECD inquiry back in 2015. And one of the things that I said to them was that we really needed to try and revisualise Curriculum for Excellence and maybe give it a midlife upgrade. If one cares to look at CFE in terms of what it's trying to do, part, I think, of the problem that we've had with CFE is that several sets of people had their hands on it. It really stems from a national debate in education, which Cathy Jameson tends to be praised or blamed for, but I actually think it was Jack McConnell before her who started the wheels in motion. I think one of the things that the Scottish government wanted to do, or the Scottish executive as it was then, wanted to do, was to try and put its own stamp on education in Scotland and actually decide how to move it forward in a way that fitted this new Scottish environment we'd all moved into in the early 21st century. So it bounced through three governing committees, an initial committee where I think Keir Bloomer was one of the leading lights, and then a second committee chaired by Maggie Allen, which took quite a different direction from the first one. And then, of course, it fell into the hands of an implementation group, which is not the same thing at all as a group of people who are trying to envisage a curriculum. I think one of the problems that it has had is it's not really based on anything other than good intentions. We really have not been very good at basing what we do in Scottish education on educational theory. Mark Priestley, the Professor of Education in Stirling University, is a fairly constant writer on curriculum theory. And Mark's view, I think, would be that we really can't demonstrate in Scotland that we have a theoretical basis for a lot of the things we've done. I would have to go back to Munn and Dunning for the last theoretical basis that I can really think of for anything we've done in Scottish education. So CFE, if you like, is the amalgam of a lot of good intentions rather than something that has a sound theoretical basis. It has a basis in that we have the four capacities. I actually did a couple of spot tests for some research I'm doing at two conferences I was speaking at, and asked people how many of them still mentioned the four capacities to their children. And sadly, the answer was a small minority of teachers appeared to be emphasising the four capacities. So maybe we're drifting a little bit from the one theoretical basis that we have for CFE, the four capacities, because it's really based on work by UNESCO, chaired, interestingly, by Jacques Delors in these post-Brexit times. And that really gave CFE its impetus. I test it against a number of things. Is it raising attainment? Because all over the original documents, we must raise attainment, and quite rightly so. One can only agree with that. But it doesn't appear to be raising attainment. There were other intents to deepen education and to give children greater choice. I think one can demonstrate that in some schools children have greater choice. And that's a very positive thing, because I think most research would demonstrate that if children are properly engaged with their learning, they're much more likely to learn. Do we have deeper learning? The OECD in 2015 said that one of the problems we have in Scottish education is that we don't have the metrics to actually test whether or not new learning is happening. And I would agree with that completely. We're testing something that was supposed to be different with the same old examination results. So we do have a problem. And if one looks at those examination results, I tend to look not only at the fourth year results, but also at the highers the year afterwards to see what's happening there. But one then needs also to remember that there were trends running in Scottish education before CFE came along. The years running up to the onset of Curriculum for Excellence in terms of examinable Curriculum for Excellence, so the years up to 2013, we were by and large very successful in Scottish education at every level, 3, 4, 5. We were getting 90, 92, 93% of the children who enrolled for a qualification through that qualification at levels 3, 4 and 5. Very successful. 2013 wasn't the strongest of years. It probably was the weakest of the last three or four before Curriculum for Excellence. And one needs to remember that because certainly my research, which has been published and commented on quite a bit, uses 2012-2013, that session, as the baseline. So one needs to remember that in using that as the baseline, the few years before that were a wee bit stronger. If I look at what's happened in Curriculum for Excellence from 2012-13, the year before it started to be examinable, through to 2015-2016, we now have 3 years of data. And those 3 years of data allow us to begin to look at trends. I think HMI would say that it's a bit early to look at trends in a major way, but one can certainly see the beginning of things. It's really quite stark to see what has happened. The common debate about how the results have changed tends to focus on how many subjects you do in the fourth year, and in some respects I actually think that's quite a sterile debate, because young people should be able to succeed irrespective of the curriculum to which they're exposed. I think my big problem is that they've been exposed to quite a varied range, and there isn't necessarily thought behind that varied range. One of the things I do as a researcher is I read the websites of every secondary school in Scotland, where they have them, because some still don't, and some have derelict websites that haven't been updated for 10 years, which is another form of difficulty. If I look at those websites and I look at the handbooks that are there or the curriculum documentation that's there, quite a lot of schools in the first 2 or 3 years give very little information to parents about the curriculum at all, either in terms of what the child would experience in fourth year or indeed how the children were attaining in fourth year. That makes it very difficult for a parent or a child to deal with Curriculum for Excellence, because obviously if they have no information in the easily available channels, they're not quite sure what to do. And I think some of the problem I'm about to summarise comes from that. let's cut to the chase. Overall enrolments in the three fourth year levels, 3, 4, and 5, are down by about 20%. Now, those who would say that that's caused by the structural problems, the changes to 6 courses or 7 courses, or even in a few schools, which must wonder why they did it, 5 courses, those changes together would reduce the number of qualifications taken across Scotland by about 14-15%. So a 20% drop in enrolments isn't that much beyond that. One might claim that that was most of the problem. However, when one looks at attainment, one sees very quickly that attainment has dropped since 2013, the last pre-CFE, has dropped by 27%. It's actually 26.9% if one wants to be accurate. That's a figure which is beyond staggering. It's a bit like Donald Trump winning 2 elections in a row in America. It really is quite a worrying number. OECD were not in a position in 2015 to look at attainment results because they felt we didn't have enough data to do it. I actually sent them some, but I'm now in a position where I have enough to see what the trends are. There was a very sharp drop in year one, and that sharp drop was much greater than the 12% drop as it was at that time because of structural issues. And we now have a situation where that has decayed further. And that's strange because one can see some of the 6-course schools going back to 7 and almost all of the 5-course schools going back to 6 or in one case, I think, 7. And the last of the 8s are beginning to move to 7 as well. So there might be stability, but if you actually look at it, there are virtually no schools doing 5 now. Less than half of the Scottish secondary schools are doing 6 courses. Approximately a third, just over a third, are doing 7 courses, and about a sixth are left doing 8 courses. So, why is it that the drop due to structural narrowing or distortion, I think distortion might be a better word, and we'll come to that, why is the drop in attainment twice the amount caused by structural change? The answer, I think, comes down to people. Because we have parents and children who, as I said, are not entirely sure what to do. In some schools have given them excellent information. We have teachers who are not, in some schools, sure what to do. And I have quite a bit of testimony from teachers in my research suggesting that they weren't very certain in the first year, they still weren't certain in the second year. All initiatives tend to take 2 or 3 years to bed in. But no prior initiative in Scottish education has dropped attainment by 30%. That's a first. I'm not sure that its owners will be proud of that first, but it is a first. Obviously, from my point of view, there are issues with respect to what head teachers and principal teachers and classroom teachers actually want from Curriculum for Excellence. I have some testimony from teachers as well that suggests that in small and small-medium schools, some of them were presented with 3 levels of potential attainment and chose to present them at 2. I have some school documentation from handbooks and other documents that shows that schools decided only to present at level 5 and level 4, and no child was presented at level 3. And if one actually looks at the attainment figures, one discovers that the problems seem, at least at first examination, to be at the bottom. Because the numbers at level 5 have held up quite well in terms of enrolments, not in terms of attainment, we'll come to that. But level 4 and level 3 enrolments dropped massively. And there are probably 2 reasons for that. One is that some of these children have been moved upstairs to the next level, either because of the presentation policy or because they and their parents wanted to do that. And some children, I suspect, in that particular column may not have been presented for anything. Obviously, the picture is obscured somewhat by the fact that levels 3 and 4 are now internally assessed. And that makes it harder to see a national examination pattern because teachers became responsible for those bits at the same time. One would have expected that attainment levels would have gone up because of teachers taking control. I suppose it's a testament to the professionalism of the profession that that doesn't seem to have happened, but one would not have expected it to go down. In the first year, although one would have expected a 12% drop due to the structural changes, the number of people doing level 5, national 5, actually really held up very well indeed. And one suspects that what happened there was that there was significant over-optimism I think all the talk of new learning and deeper learning and a narrower curriculum implies more time so everyone will do better. I think that's actually quite a naive way to see it, but I can understand the optimism that lay there. It's perhaps worth noting that before we came to Curriculum for Excellence, the conversion rate from being a candidate for a subject that you're sitting in fourth year at level five to becoming a successful attainer at level five, the rate of conversion was about 91-92% at level five, consistently across the 5 years before. We've now sunk initially rapidly and then more slowly, but we continue to sink, and the conversion rate has dropped by quite a significant distance from the low 90s to the high 70s. And of all the things that's happened in Curriculum for Excellence, that's perhaps the one that will cause most unease, because obviously the level 5 candidates are the future hire candidates. I personally am much more concerned about the level 3 and level 4 people, because if we're actually attempting to achieve equity or to close a gap, I'm not always sure which gap the government is attempting to close at any one point in time, but if I simply work on the basis that your background should not stop you from attaining as much as you should do, then that's an admirable gap to try and close. And clearly what has happened with Level 3 and Level 4 candidates is that they've disappeared. 12% of the student population in fourth year was Level 3 before we got Curriculum for Excellence. Now it's 3.5%. One would like to say that the remaining 8.5% have all moved up to Level 4 and attained, but alas, that is not true. There has been a moving up from 3 to 4 and from 4 to 5, but it's by no means clear that these children have actually attained. And in the 4 to 5 move, there is very clear statistical evidence that a lot of people moved up from 4 to 5 have failed. So I think Curriculum for Excellence is in an interesting position. In many respects, its broad aims are utterly admirable, but the detailed implementation of Curriculum for Excellence does not appear, certainly in all schools and certainly in all authorities, to have gone anything like as well as we might have hoped. If you look at the changes from previous curricular and examination systems, old grade to standard grade, standard grade to old NQs, old NQs to new NQs, all the previous changeovers had a slightly positive effect on attainment in the short term. I think probably because examiners, teachers, parents, children, head teachers, you name it, all worked very, very hard to make sure transition didn't affect anyone. It's quite the opposite this time. So something has gone wrong.
And just a couple of questions at this point, Jim. So the data that you're talking about, this is all publicly available?
These are SQA statistics. Yeah. All I do in terms of printing statistical analyses is I may invent the analysis to produce a framework to make it more easily understandable, but I simply pour SQA's numbers into the spreadsheets.
Yeah.
I've actually had them back checked by a number of people because the results were so surprising in year one that I felt I needed to make sure that I wasn't losing my marbles. I have to say that no one who's checked them has found any significant errors, so it must be true.
We've obviously had some rather large announcements in the last few months
and
last year as well, with the kind of focus on literacy and numeracy and national testing, etc. So do you have any hope that this might help in some way?
Well, anything positive that one does to improve the system is good. Do I perceive a grand plan which is actually going to take Curriculum for Excellence and do with it what the OECD suggested, which was to revisualise it and do halfway through its life upgrade process that I suggested? No, I don't, because I think we're all still in denial. I get quite interesting reactions from head teachers, because this is not the problem of the Scottish Government. I suspect there are a few politicians in other parties who'd like me to say it was solely, but although there is a governmental issue here, there's a government issue, there's a local authority issue, because local authority implementations have varied from the completely laissez-faire through to the you're all doing six. And neither of these is necessarily the most enlightened or thoughtful way of supporting schools. And then we have the school situation, where some head teachers have taken some very bold steps. Going for five courses is a very bold step. I understand from one head teacher doing five that I asked that it was done in that school because five courses was easy to timetable with fifth year and sixth year. That's not the curricular rationale, with due respect. I think a lot of the people who went for six did it on the basis of what I'm tempted to call timetabling 101 timetabling processes, which is to take the amount of time that's available and divide by various numbers of columns to see what you get, forgetting that a lot of the lead-up work will be done in third year anyway, and that the curriculum does not start in S4. We are bedevilled in Scotland by fresh starts at various points in the curriculum structure, and that simply isn't reality. So, to answer your question, I think some of the things that are being proposed, I listened carefully to John Swinney's recent speeches, and I have no doubt that the Cabinet Secretary is intent on improving things, and I think he's a decent, honest and honourable man who will try very hard. But the history of Scottish education demonstrates that we aren't always successful in our governance, and at the moment I don't see signs that his is going to be any more successful.
You've obviously written on education governance. Do the answers lie in some of the recommendations that you've made previously?
It's a brave author who decides he's got the answer to everything, so I'm not going to say yes to that one. But there are a number of excellent theorists on governance whose work is not necessarily directly applicable to education, but if you take it in the round, a lot of what's out there would apply. We still, in Scotland, we still have a desperately hierarchical system. I had a good classical education, so I tend to see them in triumvirates. We have a first triumvirate of politicians and civil servants and inspectors who have historically run the system and still do, although I think HMI's position is perhaps a little compromised. I would be happier if they were the strong balance to the civil servants and the politicians that they used to be. It's maybe not a popular thing to say to head teachers and teachers, but a strong HMI is actually very important to Scottish education. There's a second triumvirate of agencies, the teacher agency, the curricular agency, and the examinations agency. But mercifully, the teaching and examinations agencies, by and large, have not had massive problems. But we seem to be incapable in Scotland of maintaining a curriculum agency. We had the Advisory Council on Education in the 40s and 50s, which was shut down seven times, and its final report, the mighty Advisory Council report in 1947, which Professor Lindsay Patterson once wrote, echoes throughout the 20th century, and I think that's absolutely correct. It was actually ignored for 5 or 6 years and just placed on the shelf. They were dumped, the CCC was produced, they were edited several times, is probably the right way to put it. They became the SCCC. They were reviewed five times and eventually amalgamated in LTS. LTS were subjected to various quieter inquiries, I think it's fair to say, and they eventually were subsumed in another agency, Education Scotland. It's interesting to decide how much of a curricular agency Education Scotland actually is. It's got a reasonable number of inspectors still, but if I think back to the curricular strength of LTS, I'm not saying LTS was perfect, it wasn't. It had many things that needed to be improved, but it did have bodies on the ground to do the job. At the moment, I don't really see a curricular agency in Scotland, and that's not a helpful thing. If I take you back to Mark Priestley and the lack of curriculum theory in Scotland, the fact that we don't actually have an agency that speaks for the curriculum is, I think, quite a serious issue, because who else is going to do it? Ministers have neither the time nor the expertise. Civil servants, who tend to be on a rotation of every 2 or 3 years, also do not have the expertise. HMI do, but their position does appear to be somewhat compromised. Local authorities, since we deregionalised, the strength of local authorities in education departments has gone to a variable extent. Some have maintained what they have quite well, but others have become very weak indeed. And then, of course, we have head teachers. It is a sad but true fact that not all head teachers are curricular experts. And so, really, the people we would look to govern the system, the first triumvirate is weak in that area. The second triumvirate has been badly weakened by the loss of a curricular agency. And if you take the council triumvirate below that, both the directorate has been weakened and head teachers are of variable applicability to curricular leadership. So, not strength.
Go back to the data and your analysis, Jim. Are there any positives at the moment? Are there any particular subjects that are holding up, so to speak?
Yeah, yes, there are, of course. In every crisis, there is opportunity. It's quite scary because some subjects have been decimated, would be the wrong word, because no one has lost 90% of their student membership, but some have lost 60%, and that's pretty bad. But other subjects have hung on quite well. The rises have tended to be in slightly unexpected subjects. Obviously, English and maths have hung on quite well, although both have gone down. One would have expected that they would have gone down solely because of the structural factors. So one would expect to see a drop of about 14-15%, and that's exactly true of maths. But enrolments in English have dropped by 20%. So there's something happening in English there that probably needs a little look. If one looks inside the creative and aesthetic area or the technology area, there are swings and roundabouts there. Some have done well and some have done badly. Some business subjects have grown quite rapidly. Some technology subjects have grown quite rapidly. Others, traditional things like craft and design, has lost a significant percentage of its students. Accounts, which once upon a time was a staple of business, maybe in the modern era accounting is not needed anymore, but accounts has been badly battered as well. The ones that have suffered worst are probably the modern languages of the major subjects, because if one looks at attainment in French and German, now there is a long history of rise and fall in modern languages, and there have been declines before, but I can say quite happily for the viewers that this is by far the worst decline in modern languages that Scotland has ever seen. Since 2013, both French and German attainment has dropped by 60%, 59 point something percent in both cases. That's devastating. We were already a country and part of a bigger country in the UK that didn't do very well at languages anyway. It's tempting to suggest that in post-Brexit Britain we might need a few linguists because we no longer have Europeans to do our talking for us. But if I go beyond languages, the sciences are down 25-26%, all of them. The social subjects are differentially down, but some of them are down 20-odd percent. And only 14 or 15% of that can be ascribed to the structural issues. So there is a real problem. Some schools, however, I think the positive end of the spectrum lies in some schools. And I hope that HMI by now are amassing their usual database of good practice and success. Because both Keir Bloomer and I at various points in time have checked the curricular structure of all Scottish schools. And we know where that is. It's interesting to note that certainly from my researchers, but I'm happy to hear what HMI have to say, it doesn't matter whether you're doing six courses or seven courses. Some schools, I don't think fives are doing particularly well, and I think eight is a brave thing to do in these days. If you happen to have the leafiest of suburbs and parents with the buying power to support with the appropriate tutoring provision, then eight is still probably possible. But I think for most people the choice will be between six and seven. There is no reason, I don't think, why seven courses can't be carried through. As far as I can see, HMI's reports, and I read them assiduously as they're published, HMI's reports do not seem to suggest that there is an automatic failure in doing seven courses. And if one looks at published results by schools, schools are quite coy about publishing their results since 2013. It tends to be ascribed to Insight, or we can't publish that because Insight doesn't give it to us. Well, yes, it does. I know Insight well enough to know you could actually produce the comparative figures if you wanted to. And some schools have done that. Some schools are still publishing 5 at 3, 5 at 4, 5 at 5, as well as some new stats from Insight to show the equity side of things. And I think that's a highly responsible attitude. If I were in Mr. Swinney's position, I think I'd be encouraging all schools to show 5 at 3, 5 at 4, 5 at 5. Because despite what some schools and some authorities said in 2014, we can't compare with the old system because it's not the same sort of learning. Well, it is. I'm sorry, but a level 5 is still a level 5. If it's not, then either all the people who went before 2014 or all the people since have been disadvantaged. So we assume that SQA have held the level and that a level 5 is still a level 5. There's no reason, therefore, why we couldn't publish these statistics. And that would give baselines. I think one of the difficulties for local authorities and for the Scottish Government is it's actually very difficult for them to grasp anything other than the gross picture across Scotland. Very difficult to look inside a local authority or a school when they're not publishing the data. I'm sure they have that, but it's hard to see.
Just with my own setting, Jim, it's fascinating. You know, we have young people coming from, looked after and accommodated young people coming out of mainstream, and they tell us about their experiences in schools and talk about the levels of courses that they've been working towards and being presented at. And it really is interesting that you're saying that young people that we're working with multiple difficulties in their lives, you know, we're often working at National 2 and National 3 level, and we often are tearing our hair out because there's just very little in terms of resources out there, commercial resources or otherwise, and we keep being told on the quiet by certain people and certain publishers that there's not likely to be curriculum support in the future in terms of resources, for example. You seem to be suggesting that that's now almost built in the nature of Scottish education now, that there's very little presentation at these particular levels.
Well, I think it's very dangerous to assume that would be the case, because I don't believe that the 12% who were at level 3 have all suddenly become heavyweight intellectuals because they've undertaken curriculum for excellence. I think we're failing these young people if we're not providing them with courses at their level. No one is suggesting that level 3 is the end product of that child's educational life. They will go on for many years. And I know I've put thousands of children through schools with which I've been associated who've started off there and managed to climb the rungs steadily, some of them all the way into early and middle adulthood until they got to where they wanted to be. I think we do them a grave disservice if we cut that off for them. And that comes down to school or authority presentation policies. It's not a governmental choice. So, yes, there is an issue. And I also worry about what you're saying about the curriculum in terms of resourcing, because if we don't provide them with the appropriate materials and the appropriate teaching strategies, they're going to have a very difficult time. One of the ways to achieve equity is to make sure children are taught well, enthusiasm is engendered, and they have a rich environment in which to learn. And if you're jammed in with people at level 5 and level 4, it may not be devil tape behind most, but it is very hard for even the best of teachers to run around the three sets and keep all the plates spinning. I think maybe we need to do a little bit better than that. I think, however, I'm equally worried about the top end, because you were talking about trends and I've concentrated on level 4.
Yeah.
We'd had a long period of success in higher in Scotland, from the millennium right through all the way up through various Labour Liberal governments and the SNP administrations. We'd had continued growth of success at higher. Just a ripple on the pond this year. I noticed when John Swinney actually produced his statement after the results came out that he noted that there was a tremor in the higher results, because obviously everyone worries if higher goes wrong. I don't think we're at the stage of going wrong, because the 3 years before that had been very strong years. But the fact that it just went over the top when we've been working through just a couple of years of curriculum for excellence is something that's noteworthy. And if you add that to the drop at level 5, that profound drop at level 5, then one begins to worry about the future of level 6. I don't think that the most able can be knocked off the course that easily, however. All my experience of Scottish education is that no matter what you throw at the most able, they and their parents will ensure that they progress somehow anyway. But we shouldn't be hoping that that's the case. Our curriculum should make sure that they actually prosper. I go back to the very first Curriculum for Excellence reports. One of the stated aims on page 1 or page 2, I can't remember now, was raise attainment. Well, we're not raising attainment for anybody, neither the least able or the most disadvantaged, nor the most able and the least disadvantaged. We're actually doing a disservice to all of them. That is a problem.
Jim, I just want to move over for a moment to the recent OECD report on Scottish education. So can you remind listeners about the kind of key points, the key kind of recommendations from that report as you see it, and how that ties in with some of your comments this evening?
Yeah. I think, I mean, obviously the top two recommendations that they came out with were the whole idea of actually coming up with a firm, well thought out, well evidenced and theoretically based approach to achieving equity, rather than this let's close a gap or let's close another gap approach that had existed before that. I still don't see that. I do believe that the current administration seems to be working hard at it. I've got many doubts about that. But then Scottish education has been bedeviled by people who've worked very hard but not succeeded. So I think until they actually understand what they mean by equity, my personal view would be it's about a lot more than education. We need to get housing right. We need to get health right. We need to get education right. We need to make sure that all social services work properly. It's a coordination of those things, not just saying the teacher will solve the problem by doing the following. So there's that. The other main recommendation, I suppose, was that they actually do what I was talking about earlier on, which is to come up with a new framework for Curriculum for Excellence, a new narrative that explains what Curriculum for Excellence is, how teachers and parents and young people should approach it, and how it can actually be best worked to achieve those targets that were set out originally way back by Keir Blumenthal. I mean, obviously, there are other things as well, and one of the other things probably is one of the roots of the problem, because I think it's the fourth of their recommendations is to strengthen leadership and strengthen the middle. And I've been talking about the fact that it's a very hierarchical system. It's still a very hierarchical system. If anyone's unwise enough to go and find my doctorate and read it, it contains evidence from 100 leaders of Scottish education who are all saying that the system doesn't work very well. So it's not me. And that does bother me quite a bit. We simply have not engaged with governance theory. Governance theory would say that leading any major public activity is difficult, that politicians necessarily have to describe it simply because they're driven by television and sound bites, whereas the actual process is immensely complex. You do not turn an education system around in 5 minutes, 5 years, or maybe even 10 years. It takes a great deal of work, and it also takes a system joined up and working together. I looked with great interest when I was doing my doctorate at how the layers of governance of education in Scotland work together. And the answer from people in all the layers, whether they were in the top layer of civil servants and ministers or the middle layer of agencies or the local authority layer, all of them seemed to think that there were things that could be improved quite significantly. I got them to rate themselves and each other for the quality of their governance. None of them were very kind to themselves, which is very honest. I think the most common thing that anyone said to me was, I blame myself because. And then that was followed either by, I should have done the following, or I just went along with something that I knew wasn't necessarily going to work very well. And I think that's down to hierarchy to a large extent. I'm not for a moment recommending the English system to anyone, because I think they've gone to the opposite extreme, where there are 105 ways of doing things. But maybe we need to get a bit more real about the fact that teachers and head teachers and local authority people have as much to contribute in actually making something work than someone who sits in the civil service office in Edinburgh. We have this superficiality of partnership and cooperation, and nice noises are made in government reports about that on a regular basis. But I'm not actually sure that's carried through. And that seemed to be where OECD were in 2015 with their strength in the middle. I'm intrigued by the government's response to strength in the middle, because strength in the middle seems to be coming from doing away with the middle and from setting up an international committee of experts who will zoom in from time to time and tell us all what to do and then zoom out again. I would confidently predict that even though the mighty Andy Hargreaves is there and one or two other people that I rate highly, that isn't going to work. Because teachers and principal teachers and head teachers and directors of education in local authorities take what comes down to them from above and they reinterpret it to meet their local conditions, and then it goes to the school and it's reinterpreted, and then it goes to the department and it's reinterpreted, and then the teacher reinterprets it, and then of course the children reinterpret for their own purposes. So nothing is quite as simple as it's portrayed to be. I think perhaps the way down the list in OECD, the idea of building teacher capital, is one of the crucial parts of the process. We need to get away from the idea of the autonomous professional. Nobody is autonomous, but we are quasi-autonomous. Once the door is closed, the teacher is there with the children, and that tends to be what an environment is generated within which learning and teaching happens. And however much that's moderated by visitors, it still is what it is. We need to work very hard on making sure that we raise the level of maybe the bottom 10 or 15% of teachers and principal teachers and head teachers and directorate people up to a level that's more acceptable. A lot of HMI reports have very sagely and quite correctly said that the problem in the end comes down to the school you're in and the class you're in, and that there is no consistency. I think some of the initiatives we've tried to carry through have engendered consistency by pulling us all down to a level. And what we really need to do is to grow people upwards. But that implies trust and support and cooperation. And that doesn't work very well in the hierarchy.
Jim, just to finish up, what kind of current work are you involved in that might help to point us in a direction or take us in a positive direction? And also, if you can enlighten us, based on what you've spoken about tonight, what are you presently telling policymakers
who wish to listen? I think one of the common threads of educational research in Scotland, churned out by much more important people than me, Lindsay Patterson, Walter Humes, people like that, for years have been saying little account is taken of research. Interestingly, I wrote it in my response to OECD, and so did several other people I know, and it came through in the OECD report, a direct statement to the government that it needed to take more account of research. But of course, they've gone to an international research panel rather than looking at domestic research, so I don't think things are going to change there. I think there are some things that will come that may be helpful. For a start, there are people like Keir Bloomer, I mentioned before, and the Educational Reform Society are actually trying to focus on some of the major issues. There are some big organisations in Scotland. The Royal Society of Edinburgh has consistently produced reports that are helpful, but they haven't always been adhered to. What am I doing? I always believe that if you say things are not right, you should try and make them better. So I have been. I have a chapter coming out in a new book, and interestingly an English book, on modern languages, trying to point out what the issues are in modern languages. But I have three papers that I'm working on just now that I'm just about to send to journals. One on the governance of Scottish education, to try and make the obvious points that it hasn't worked very well. Really, since regions were done away with, I'm not suggesting regions were anything like perfect, and they were nothing like consistent. Strathclyde and the Western Isles were not quite the same thing. But there was strength in some of them, and it was used well in some of them. I look back at Michael O'Neill's time in North Lanarkshire and the advisory service and support services that he ran, which were exemplary, and I don't see that now. I just don't see it around at all. I have two papers coming out in Scotland, although they may go wider in the end. One paper on how Curriculum for Excellence got from where it started to where it is now and what might be done about it. It's got a very nice set of 10 questions in it which are worth answering. And then finally, I've got a report on the Scottish curriculum and the influences which have shaped it or failed to shape it. And that might stir up a bit of debate. I have a colleague in Strathclyde, I think it is Alan Britton, who has looked at curriculum for excellence in that sort of context as well, to look at the influences. So maybe two or three of us are beginning, and we've mentioned Mark Priestley as well. I think there is a growing consensus of interest amongst academics in doing something about Scottish education, if only to provide politicians, who in the end are responsible, with the ammunition to perhaps govern it a little better than they have before.
Jim, thank you so much for taking time out on this Sunday evening to join us on Radio EduTalk. It's been fascinating listening to you over the last half hour or so, and I'll say again to listeners to the podcast, you can get in touch in two ways. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, or you can pop something up on Twitter and include the hashtag EduTalk. So thanks again, Jim, and best wishes for the future.
Thanks very much, David.